everyone. This is Robert Lloyd, PhD student at Georgia State University's Urban Studies Institute. I'm really excited to be here with you, partly because it's my first time contributing to the Future Cities podcast, but also because I'm going to tell you about a couple of subjects I'm intensely interested in. One is infrastructure, and the other is one of my favorite cities, New Orleans, Louisiana. As I'm recording this, New Orleans is a really timely topic. Hurricane Zeta just hit the city, doing significant damage, but nothing like the widespread and long-term flooding New Orleans experienced 15 years ago after Hurricane Katrina proved too much for its levees and flood walls and got people thinking about new ways for the Crescent City to handle water. Now, whether they were spurred by natural disasters or not, there have been terrific advances in environmental science and infrastructure in the past few decades. But a lot of the time, the problem isn't technological so much as it is social. Policies, funding structures, and even community sentiment can slow down much-needed changes. Later on, I'm going to share with you an interview with a fantastic person leading great work on addressing the social end of water management in New Orleans. But first, another thing that's happening as I'm recording this is that the COVID-19 pandemic is still grinding on, and a lot of travel has been curtailed. So I'm going to invite you to let the Future Cities podcast take you away on an audio journey to learn more about the social response to environmental challenges as they've been playing out with water in the Big Easy. New Orleans is famous for its charming architecture, its freewheeling atmosphere, and its public performance culture. But over the last 15 years, it's become well known for other reasons. One of them is trouble with water management. You don't even need to be a student of urban ecology to know about the environmental challenges New Orleans faces. You just have to look at the news.
The governor of Louisiana said today that she is considering the remarkable step of evacuating the remaining residents of New Orleans. A water main broke, leaving New Orleans without drinking water. And the flooding here is getting worse after waters from Lake Pontchartrain broke through a levee. And with much of New Orleans now underwater, authorities are focused on search and rescue before it's too late.
If ever the cavalry was needed, it is now, and it is in New Orleans. An Army National Guard.
The failures of New Orleans levees and flood walls after Hurricane Katrina in 2005 was an international story. And the effects of that disaster can still be seen in parts of the city. But the truth is, lower scale flooding is all too common there.
Good evening, and thanks for watching. I'm Kristen Pierce. Heavy downpours in New Orleans left many streets flooded for hours this afternoon. Some reports are suggesting 4 inches of rain fell during 1 hour, leaving some in mid-city stuck inside their homes. Duke Carter caught up with people who live on Orleans Avenue who have a lot of cleaning up to do.
A serious rainstorm can cause water to build up and stay even outside of hurricane-level events. Why is that? Well, it comes down to a combination of ecology and infrastructure. Even though New Orleans was founded on a ridge to establish French colonizers' control of the Mississippi River, it didn't stay on high ground. The new settlement's value as a port drew lots of people to the opportunity of work, as well as the developing European-American idea of a civilized community as a place where people live and work in permanent concentration. All those people needed room to live, and the high areas by the river weren't big enough for all of them. So the lower-lying areas gradually began to be drained and levied. In the 19th century, that process intensified with the introduction of Albert Baldwin Wood's screw pumps, powerful engines which drew out the groundwater and pumped it out into nearby Lake Pontchartrain to ensure land inside the flood walls stayed firm enough to build on. This process was successful enough that by the mid-20th century, half the land area of New Orleans was actually below sea level, kept dry and firm enough to build and live on by the water management infrastructure. The wood screw pumps are still in operation in New Orleans today, dumping huge amounts of water outside the massive flood walls that surround the city. All that infrastructure turned out to be precarious, though, as Hurricane Katrina showed. Study of that disaster after the fact showed that the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers-approved flood walls weren't nearly up to the task of even a moderately strong Category 3 hurricane like Katrina. New ones installed since 2005 haven't solved the problem, in spite of their $14 billion price tag. An assessment of its own work by the Corps in early 2019 showed that thanks to climate change and coastal erosion, the new system will become inadequate to protect the city in just a few years. Adding to that problem is the fact that land under the city is subsiding, thanks to the groundwater pumping that was meant to help make the city habitable in the first place. So, is there actually a long-term solution to the water all around, underneath, and falling into the Crescent City? Well, some people think they've found it. Rather than walling and pumping all the water out, they say, the answer is to let it in. Incorporating water features like canals and wetland parks throughout the city would relieve pressure on the system. Unfortunately, such sweeping infrastructure changes aren't so easy to implement. One example of how this went down in New Orleans is the Lafitte Greenway. The Lafitte Greenway stretches for just over 2.5 miles through the center of New Orleans. It started out the way a lot of new urban trail systems have, as disused railway and industrial space. The 2002 update of New Orleans' Comprehensive Land Use Plan made conversion of old railways to trails a city priority. After Hurricane Katrina in 2005, though, a new element was suggested: blue infrastructure. Regular listeners here have probably heard a lot about green infrastructure. Blue infrastructure works along the same idea, using nature features and processes to meet the goals of older styles of infrastructure. Blue infrastructure focuses on water management, and it involves returning streams, canals, wetlands, and ponds to city spaces where before they had been filled in, covered up, and paved over. Blue infrastructure is typically paired with green styles to mimic an environment prior to urbanization. It can be more efficient and resilient, and often a lot more aesthetically pleasing than the old concrete and asphalt. As the Lafitte Greenway concept moved forward after Katrina, discussion with Dutch scientists indicated the potential value of including blue infrastructure features within the trail area. The corridor used to serve that function anyway. Before the railway was put in, the Carondelet Canal ran through what's now the Greenway. Unfortunately, the planning and funding process for the Greenway was already rolling ahead. A large portion of the money came from federal disaster relief funds with strict rules on the timeline in which they had to be used. Ultimately, the only water management features that made their way into the Lafitte Greenway were some bioswales. Now, there's no question the Greenway is a terrific amenity. It's constantly used by pedestrians and bicyclists. I've biked it lots of times myself. But it's a shame a way couldn't have been found to incorporate the major water management features proposed. The possibility isn't gone for good. Further blue infrastructure installations to the Greenway could move forward as part of the Greater New Orleans Urban Water Plan. Introduced in 2013, it's a sweeping proposal to completely re-engineer the city's water management system along the lines of that "let the water in" philosophy. Old canals would be reopened or expanded, wetland parks would be created in particularly low-lying areas, and streets would be re-engineered to better manage stormwater and still be negotiable by people, bicycles, and cars during a flood event. It sounds like a workable, fantastically forward-thinking design. One stumbling block, though, is the cost. Something like $6 billion for full implementation, and that's the 2013 calculation. Even though New Orleans received over $2 billion from FEMA to repair and improve its water management infrastructure after Hurricane Katrina, just as with the Lafitte Greenway, projects using that money were on tight execution timelines, and the city was unwilling to delay them to incorporate new green and blue infrastructure elements. So it sounds like one thing New Orleans has going on is familiar to people working on social problems of all kinds. Path dependency. The city is so locked into old ways of doing things that it's hard to break out even when a new way is presented. Cities like New Orleans are working so hard just to maintain status quo, not just in the face of climate change, but more everyday problems, that it's hard for them to shift gears and change course, unless maybe they're forced to by, say, the next big hurricane. And when part of their support for maintaining that status quo is something like federal funding, which doesn't allow for much wiggle room and rethinking, it just gets that much harder. What this means is that the next phase of cities adapting to sustainability and resiliency threats isn't necessarily technological. A lot of that work has already been done. Instead, it's going to involve projects which are potentially much, much harder. Designing and putting in place new systems of funding and management that allow cities to break out of the well-worn tracks they've been on for decades, as well as to make sure that changes happen in an equitable way. There is hope in New Orleans. Some parts of the Urban Water Plan are moving forward as demonstration projects. In 2020, the city installed a number of test sections of permeable parking lanes in one part of the Central City neighborhood. And work began this year on the Mirabeau Water Garden, a 25-acre wetland park on the site of a former convent. Proposed as part of the Urban Water Plan, the Mirabeau Garden is just one project of many underway to form an entire resiliency district centered on the Gentilly neighborhood. Other work includes new stormwater capture and storage features throughout the area, and wetlands and improved drainage on the Dillard University campus, as well as water infrastructure workforce development and placemaking activities to improve public understanding of the living with water concept. Hopefully, these projects will be just the start. If New Orleans manages to overcome not only the difficulties common to many cities, but also its own unique set of challenges, it won't just rise above the water, it'll be a shining example of how a city can truly transform. Well, welcome back, everybody. I am very lucky right now to be talking to Jessica Dandridge, who is Executive Director of the Water Collaborative, an organization in New Orleans which is doing terrific work to advocate for water safety, water security, and all sorts of related issues. The Water Collaborative is based in New Orleans. So, welcome, Jessica, to the Future Cities podcast.
Thank you so much, Robert. I'm really excited to be here today.
Well, we're excited to have you. So why don't we start by having you talk about your background and how you got into this line of work?
Absolutely. It's like everybody's journey. It's kind of a long but short story. So I am born here in New Orleans. I was raised in the 7th Ward here, which if you know the area, is a very popular area near downtown. I had a very normal childhood, like I think most people did, but speaking in terms of the Water Collaborative, we didn't really have a lot of access to water in the ways people think. People in New Orleans generally don't think of themselves as a water city. We think of the coast as water. And so I grew up seeing levees, I grew up seeing canals, but I never really understood what that meant. And so fast forward a little bit, I love to say I'm a Katrina kid as well. My birthday is actually the day after Hurricane Katrina hit. And I was actually turning 16 at the time. So my life in many ways has been shaped around Hurricane Katrina, particularly in my maturity as I was growing into age. And when I came back after the city was closed, I really became really active and really wanted to know how I can better improve my community, how I can change the trajectory of how our city is shaped. There's no other words to describe Hurricane Katrina, you know, it's just everything starting from scratch, literally. And so I saw this as a great time to be a part of the redevelopment process of my city. So I became a youth organizer at 16 and learned about the ins and outs of nonprofits in ways that I think most people don't really get to learn until they're in their late 20s or early 30s. I wrote my first grant at, I was 18 years old, wrote a grant for Ford Foundation, and we got it for $50,000 for 3 years. So that just speaks a lot to my mentors and how much they taught me. So I stayed in this work until I was about 21 years old, needed a break. And during that time, I was also in college. I went to Xavier University of Louisiana, studying political science and sociology. And I always loved policy work. I always loved community work and really thinking about community engagement, community outreach, and how we can get more voices involved in the developments of our government particularly. I then moved to New York City. I needed a change of scenery. I wanted to learn new things. I also at the time was getting my master's at the New School of Public Engagement at Milano. And ironically, I was studying security and not what you would think. I didn't study nonprofit management because when I looked at what the classes were, I laughed. I said, well, I already know all this. I already did it. And so I actually studied security with the hopes of actually doing international work. I was really interested in working in Middle Eastern countries around, again, same thing, community involvement, community engagement, and did that for a few years. When I graduated, the world had changed. I graduated in 2016, the same year President Trump became president. And I was told by people in the international field that things were going to change. They already saw the writing on the wall. This was before the 2020 election. And they knew that funding was going to be decreased. They knew that the environment around community work was going to change. And so I moved back home shortly after graduating. And my first job, I was working for Rockefeller Family Foundation, which is under Rockefeller Foundation, doing democratization of rural electric cooperatives in the Black Belt of Alabama. And that was my first time as a program director working with low-income communities in the Black Belt, particularly farmers, Black farmers, on how to democratize an electric cooperative that has been historically racist, practiced nepotism, poorly managed. There's a lot of problems over there. And I did that for 2.5 years. And I had other things in between. I've been consulting for various groups and organizations. I did strategic planning for nonprofits. And I'm here now at the Collaborative. I've been here for 1.5 years. And I think one of the reasons I talked to the board and why they chose me is one, they really saw my community work as important. When we think of water and climate, we oftentimes don't think of community engagement. It's usually engineers, it's usually data professionals, ecologists, environmentalists, but they're working in their areas and they're not really bringing that information to the people. Sure. And after the Urban Water Plan, we can probably get into that. I'm kind of jumping around a little bit, but they saw that community was more involved and more interested in this work, right? And they needed someone to basically better communicate the changes in the environment, the changes in policy to local people. And so being an African-American woman, someone who's from the area, who's done community work for many years prior to this, they saw me as a good fit. And I think so far it's worked out. And be really transparent, I did not know anything about green infrastructure before I started this job. And but now I absolutely love it. I love stormwater management. I couldn't see myself in another field. Out of everything that I've done, this is probably one of my most exciting and favorite topics.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And given your background and where you come from and your experience in New Orleans, it sounds like, you know, this was a natural fit. It was also almost like destiny guided you there.
It did. I thought for a long time I was going to go work overseas. I lived in Morocco for a while. I wanted to go back and I wanted to go work in North Africa particularly. And, you know, I always say the universe has its own plan. And in many ways, it brought me right back here. But I'm also not surprised. When I was at the New School, I was studying urbanization and security and conflict in urban areas. So I already knew I wanted to work in urbanization, work on, you know, how cities can become smart and thrive and sustainability. But I was really interested in the fact that many of the cities, out of all the cities we think about in these conversations internationally, of course, they talk about Singapore, Kyoto, the Netherlands, but they also bring up New Orleans. New Orleans is a constant subject matter and a study about the relationships and intersections of race, of classism, of policy, of government. And when you're looking at government failure, but also community input and community voice. And so I was thinking to myself, well, I should be at the forefront of these conversations in class. And when I'm doing my my internships in New York City, they're always talking about New Orleans. And so in a way, I knew everything about Katrina because I lived it. And I knew what that process felt like from going from nothing to what we are today as a city in 2020. We've made huge strides, but we have a lot of work to do. But I'm saying that to bring into circle or holistically that I had the experience already that people were writing in books and theorizing and creating opinion pieces on, and I've lived it. And so it made a lot of sense for me to come back home to take that expertise with me into this field in particular, which is going to be the new trajectory of New Orleans, because green infrastructure, stormwater management, in my opinion, is the sector that is going to overcome and expand much faster than tourism and oil and gas could ever do. So, the universe definitely brought me back at the right time too.
And you really bring with you a blend of not only your educational experience, the work experience that you already built up along the way, but also a very personal connection to the place that you're working in, obviously, and a lot of personal experience about the issues that you are working with.
Absolutely. You know, my family's born and raised here in Louisiana. I'm a Louisiana girl through and through. My family's from Brobridge, Louisiana, which is about 2 hours outside of New Orleans, and goes generations back. So that's one aspect of it. But my family has been impacted by water before I was even born. My family had lived through Betsy, Hurricane Betsy, and they've lived through Hurricane Camille. And in both those cases, low-income communities and low-lying communities were flooded from Lake Pontchartrain or the Mr. Go. And so both of those cases have shaped how I see my life, right? And how my family has reacted to hurricanes and reacted to flooding in the city. And even though we didn't have the terms that we have today, when we call about subsidence and erosion and coastal resilience, it was well understood that people in the city, particularly people who were of color, people who were low income, were going to always be at the forefront of mismanagement and lack of environmental understanding of the impacts of water. And so it feels full circle to me that I'm back here trying to improve, working to improve what has negatively impacted my family three times over.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I think you've brought us round to a great talking point, and that is the Water Collaborative itself. Maybe you can tell me and the listeners more about what the organization does and what you do as the leader of it.
Yeah, so it definitely brings all of my skill sets together, but it's a very unique organization. So the Water Collaborative was actually founded as a grassroots kind of movement. It was many people working in the sector who, before stormwater management and green infrastructure was a thing, it wasn't sexy as it is now, they were talking about it. And so leaders in the sector met up a couple times a month, a couple times a year, just saying, hey, we should all be working together cross sector in multidisciplinary ways to tackle this issue. And over time it grew. And so by 2015, they did a massive strategic planning process and partnership with several organizations. In 2017, it became official. And so what the Water Collaborative is today is it serves many purposes, but the main goal is to bring the sector together to be a bridge of resources, information, tools, and skill sets, particularly focused on water and basically ensuring communities can live and thrive with water. And so I like to explain live and thrive. It's not just flooding and natural disasters, which I think people automatically go to, but it's also making sure, one, people understand why the environment is the way it is. It's also making sure we talk about utilities and government, because water is very much what we drink. It's very much what we have around us when we think about our waterways, our sewage, and just a natural way cities operate, but also loving water. Particularly in Louisiana, New Orleans specifically, we don't love water. We want it gone as quickly as possible, as fast as possible. And so changing the understanding and culture around water and saying it's okay for there to be waterways and canals, and it improves property value, but it also improves your liveliness and your health. So helping residents understand that it's okay to love it. So we bring all of these organizations and businesses together. We bring nonprofits, private industry, as well as elected officials and government agencies together to basically work together. And why that's important is because we, and I think every industry has this problem, but we work in silos. Often people, if you work in this particular field, that's all you do. You don't talk to somebody in a different field who's working on the same subject matter. And while in other areas it may not be that problematic, water doesn't operate that way. And water is a watershed, right? We can talk about that some. Water doesn't care about your zip code. It doesn't care about what you do. So when one person, for instance, says, I'm going to build me a rain garden or, you know, a small levee, you're going to impact the next person over, right? You're going to impact the next household over, you're going to impact the next business over, or the next parish. So helping people understand that idea of regionalism, that idea of we're all in this together, particularly around water, is what we're trying to do. And I bring a unique asset by understanding community voice. I've worked in every level, whether it's been local to government, and trying to bridge those gaps between understanding each other. And I think that's our biggest goal, is building trust amongst people who necessarily wouldn't work together or don't necessarily see eye to eye. And so that's our big macro way of seeing what we do here at the Water Collaborative.
Sure, excellent. And yeah. You know, you mentioned building trust. I think it's not much of a stretch to say that trust can be a particular challenge in a city like New Orleans, which has been through so much. Some of the efforts at rebuilding and maintaining the city and changing it in lots of ways, some obviously for the better, some arguably not.
Right.
But, so some people have been left out of that equation or feel that they have been left out.
Yeah, I mean, I think even I have felt that way for a long time, which is why I left. Being a young organizer at 16, I was working really on equity and education and really focusing on preventing an all-chartered system. And now New Orleans has an all-chartered system. And I can just use that as a small anecdotal example. You know, we try to prevent all the public schools from going charter. The city, the state, federal government really want to push that because the Orleans Parish School Board was basically broke, right? All their properties are flooded out. They don't have the money. So they chartered them out to cover cost, to open up schools faster. And I totally understand that. But the goal was to not have that be the long-term case and to go back to public schools, which were more community-based. In essence, it didn't happen. And in that process, I've seen other examples, such as the housing crisis that we're in now is really attributed to the fact that the city council voted to tear down all the housing projects and not rebuild them to the same level. And it was a huge impact on how I view government. I didn't trust it. I said, well, we did all the right things that they tell you to do, right? We voted, we went to city council meetings. I remember the city council chambers were full. People were standing room only. I remember us doing petitions and writing letters and having meetings with elected officials, and yet still they made the decisions that really benefited community, didn't benefit the community, and really benefited business and private investors. Mm-hmm. And so now that I'm back here, I really think that my role is to try to not just prevent things like that from happening, but understanding where we made mistakes. And I can reflect on that now and say, I think there were some things that we didn't understand. But there are also things that we want to prevent from happening as well. And building trust is key to all of that, because a lot of people who have lived through Katrina, and I'm using my examples, but I mean, just the whole system, right? I mean, the idea that levees are breaking, you trust the Army Corps of Engineers to not do that. You know, people often think of Hurricane Katrina as an environmental failure, but it was a human failure. It was man-made failure, because we did not do our due diligence on making sure our water systems were strong, and updating them as they were supposed to be. So that moment of the levees breaking to the process of, you know, the federal government failing, the state government failing, city government failing, every aspect of Hurricane Katrina and the history of New Orleans is about government failure. And there's not too many people who were born and raised here who have a positive outlook on government. Even in the case now, I think we have a really passionate group of elected officials here in New Orleans who really do care. It doesn't matter that there's always a little bit of skepticism, a little bit of concern that who are you doing this for? And so all of that to say, I try to take these meetings that I sit in, I try to take the committees and advisory boards, and I try to digest that information. I speak up for the community, but I also understand that maybe sometimes things just get lost. I like to say lost in the sauce. And how can I take that information that's important and bring it to the community to build trust? How can I get a community member in the room with someone who's elected official? And we actually just did it, and it was such a great experience. We actually had a board retreat. It was totally unintentional. It was just a regular retreat. We're social distance with our masks on, but we had to conduct business. And I remember the day before, I had the meeting in a local home of my mentor who lives in Treme. And when they heard I was coming, the whole neighborhood was like, oh my God, we need your help. Please help us. They were doing street work and street repairs, and nobody knew why. They had made mistakes. There was people getting their cars towed. There were no notification. I mean, it was just a lot of missteps. And literally the whole community was like calling, texting, saying, oh my God, what can you do? So instead of me just trying to push them off, I actually invited the community members to the board meeting. And I had them speak to my board. I have people on my board who are engineers, who are members of the city, members of staff of the city, I should say, who are staff at Sewage and Water Board, which is a local utility. And both sides ended up so happy at the end because they had never spoken to each other. The community members felt like, I now have a grasp of why things are happening. But then the city workers and the utility workers felt like, well, I think we dropped the ball here when we can improve on this. But it was a civil conversation where now trust was built. And I got a phone call just a few days later, maybe 3 days later, where the community member said, why can't we do this all the time? And it really speaks to the mission of our organization and bringing these groups together. And that's what we try to continually do on all levels, you know, in our work.
Yeah, absolutely. That's fantastic. You know, I feel like when we talk about managing environmental challenges, manning infrastructure in a city, you know, it's very easy to go out and look at, for instance, legislation, which is on the books. It may be easy to look over a city budget. The technical aspects, if you're an engineer, you know, it can be fairly easy to see, to look at a stormwater diagram, a set of blueprints for the stormwater system, and be able to tell, okay, this is going to work in this way. It'll handle this much water in these conditions and so forth. But things like community sentiment and community awareness can be so slippery and so hard to pick up on. And then when you add in the fact that there may be very poor communication between the community, between residents, and between city governments, contractors, developers, and so forth, then that can just make it all the more difficult, which is why I think, you know, organizations like the Water Collaborative are so valuable in this process.
Yeah, it's really, and it's, you think it's, I hate to say it this way, but it's not rocket science. It's pretty simple to bring a community member in the room with city workers, right, contractors, engineers, to just talk about an issue. And so I think what we have to learn is that it's okay to be vulnerable. And I think I have to tell that to my board all the time. The key component to the Water Collaborative's name is collaboration, right? And somewhere along the lines of American history, we thought collaboration meant like singing Kumbaya with the fire, and we're all gonna work out and it's all gonna be great and we're gonna walk into the sunset together. Collaboration is not like that.
Sure.
Collaboration is hard work. It is, your feelings may get hurt. You may not always agree with each other. You may leave disgruntled. You may leave feeling like a failure sometimes. I leave meetings sometimes and I think I have the best idea, and then someone says, no, your idea was absolutely terrible. But being comfortable with vulnerability is so important to collaboration. And being comfortable with feedback is really important to collaboration. And not everyone has practiced that. And I can say why what makes the work we do unique is that, and particularly in my experience, is that most people have never done that in an intentional way, right? Many engineers have to, and government agencies have to check a box. Okay, we do a public meeting. Okay, we do a public meeting and we have to do 10 a year before this project, an environmental evaluation. And what they do is often they have a slide deck or presentations or, you know, big graphics to say, look what we've already decided on, what do you think? That's not intentional collaboration, that's not intentional community outreach. That's community awareness, right? You just made the community aware that you're doing something. It's a different conversation to have when you're saying, I want the community to collaborate with me and help me build out ideas, to help me better understand what I'm doing and how I can do it better, and vice versa. And that's, again, it requires vulnerability. It requires you to step back from your professional degree or whatever that is and say, I'm gonna let you in to help me better understand how I can do my job better. And we're not accustomed to that, I think, especially as people in this sector environment where we've worked, or I would say people who've worked, because I've not worked in this sector my whole life, but I'm understanding that a lot of people in this sector have worked alone, or they've worked again in their sector. And so it's a different kind of conversation to ask people who you may not agree with, who you may not have any relationship to via gender, sexuality, race, class, and to ask them in. And so collaboration is, again, it's hard work, but it is necessary. And so that meeting that I just explained earlier with a community member, I'm not gonna lie and tell you, it was the first 10 minutes was a little tense, right? Because I kind of surprised them. I didn't tell them in advance. I wanted to do that on purpose, because if I prepared them, they would have had perfectly made statements and it would have probably came with flyers and all kinds of knickknacks. I wanted them to be authentic in both of those cases. And after the first 10 minutes, all of that melted away. And so practicing that at the collaborative with our members, with our board, with our partners, is not always easy. I don't always get yay hurrahs when I do that in a meeting. Some days I do. But I understand that the long-term goal is much more important than the short-term.
Yeah. You know, we're recording this in mid-October, and Hurricane Delta has just hit southwestern Louisiana, the second hurricane to hit that area in just a few months. And of course, we're also in the middle of the still ongoing COVID-19 pandemic. We are recording this interview virtually, of course, and you already made reference to having to mask up for these public meetings. So there's a lot of challenges going on, and it seems like it would be very easy for area residents to maintain cynicism, to maintain a certain amount of pessimism about the future of the area. But also, you know, I think you certainly know as a native and a resident, and I know as a student of the area and way too briefly a resident, the fierce love that people can have for New Orleans and the region that it sits in. And so that has to be a plus as well. So maybe you can talk, and you already alluded to the fact that even internationally, New Orleans is a hot topic of conversation. I'm sure not only about the sustainability and resilience.
No, I think I get more questions about my gumbo than I do about what I do. But, you know, I think one thing I want to start off with saying is that one of our partners from IC Change, Julia Drapkin, who was amazing, said on a recent call together that we are living through a crisis turducken. And I said, this is the perfect analogy. And for those who don't know what a turducken is, it's like a chicken stuffed inside of a duck, stuffed inside of a turkey, yes, with like fragua and sausage. And it's the most rich thing you could probably ever eat.
It's amazing. Yeah,
it's amazing. And it's like 40 pounds. And so that's what we're living in, right? We're talking about the chicken is, I would even go as far as the micro and saying these technical issues of city, right, and government and things that we've overlooked for a long time about our processes, voting, civil rights, and other things like that on a, again, localized level, right? Our day-to-day interactions, right? Our duck is the way we, our philosophies around all of this, right? How are we talking about these things? What are our values as a society, as a community? What are our moral compasses? And our turkey is, how are we all gonna work together to do this, right? How can we, again, collaborate party to party, race to race, gender to gender identity? We're living through a little crisis turducken. And in between this turducken, the frogwise, the public health concerns, right? The poverty concerns, the housing concerns, homelessness, environment, climate change. It's a crisis turducken, and you can't eat the whole thing. And so the first thing I would tell people, and what I think people in New Orleans understand, is you can't eat the whole turkey, turducken, right? You eat a slice and you enjoy your slice and you savor it, and then you save the rest for everyone else. So people in New Orleans have understood this, in my opinion, is that we take it day by day. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of, when I lived in New York, and I remember, I love New Yorkers, but I kind of chuckled a little bit when Hurricane Sandy hit. And it was, a hurricane is a hurricane, it's devastating. But I was interesting to see their reaction, right? They're like, oh my God, a hurricane hit, and what are we gonna do? And I was like, you rebuild and you know, you figure it out. And they just, they looked at me with like such, you know, dismay, like how could she be so calm about this? Because when people who haven't lived through disasters on a regular basis, you wanna chew the whole thing. You wanna take in the whole 30 pound turkey or turducken and try to fix it all overnight. And you can't. And my old mentor, she passed away, but she always said, think of community work as building a house. You don't build the whole house in a day, right? You take on the first level and the second level, and you put the wood up and the sheetrock, and then you may decorate this room and decorate that room, but you're never done, right? When you have a home, you never say, well, I put the furniture in, hands up, I'm done, dust it off. No, you have to maintain. You may want to change your pillows. And I said, this is such a simple but yet genius way of thinking about how we approach society. We approach it by taking on each room day by day. And with New Orleans in particular, we understood that particularly, again, we've lived through Betsy, Camille, other hurricanes that I'm not even mentioning that we've survived, but we've been through a lot of trauma. And that's not to take that away. Trauma is trauma. There's no other way around it. But I think we've understood that it's okay to take it day by day. But we also understand the beauty of our community. One of the most frustrating things I got after Hurricane Katrina, when I was going around and traveling, is like, well, why does New Orleans exist? Mm-hmm. Like, why do we need to be there? Yeah. When I was younger, I didn't really have the response. I'm already traumatized. So I'm like, why would somebody ask me something? So just to me, it was a very rude question. But I would say now that I'm an adult, I think that why wouldn't it be here? Every single city in the world, every single rural area in the world is impacted by something. Is that a reason for communities not to exist or not to live or not to thrive? But then we even go to the practical fact concept that New Orleans not only is a major cultural hub for the United States, but it's also a cultural hub for the world. But it's also a number one place where we get our seafood. People forget that most of the America's seafood comes from Louisiana.
Absolutely.
Yeah, no, that's people's favorite part, right? The food. But also we are then one of the major hubs, one of the busiest ports in the world, especially when you talk about imports from South America and Asia. We don't think about those things and the practicality of it. I remember after Katrina, the prices of gas rose extremely high and people around the country were like, well, why is this happening? Well, because the oil and gas workers aren't there. And again, I'm not putting a lot on oil and gas because we need to divest from that. But I think it's important to understand that every community is important. But no matter what you're doing, whether you're in California right now dealing with forest fires, or you're in Miami, you're also dealing with flooding, or you're in Nevada, you're dealing with too much heat and not enough water, that every community matters. And I think that's one thing that New Orleanians understood, and we live off of that. We are prideful in everything we do. And my friends in New York used to hate me. They'd be like, oh my God, if she talks about New Orleans one more time. But I love to remind people of like the contributions of Louisiana to the country. And yes, politically, we're not perfect, but culturally and socially, we have a lot of benefits. And I being prideful of your city helps, and it's like a little bit of a personal therapy, I guess you could say, as you're trying to rebuild your life.
Yeah. I think everybody I know is tired of me talking about New Orleans too, but we're not going to stop.
I'm never going to stop. I'm going to talk about New Orleans till the day I die. And it's just because, you know, somebody was like, oh, you know, they talked about Harlem. And I was like, well, you know, jazz came from Louisiana, from New Orleans specifically. You know, they're like, oh, here she goes. I am a huge nerd too. So I know a lot about New Orleans history and Louisiana history. So I love to tell people that, so they understand that a city is not just its structures, it's the people, it's contributions to our world. And just because something traumatic happened, it doesn't mean that we should disown that society or that community.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, Jessica Dandridge, this has been a fantastic conversation. And I love the work of the Water Collaborative, and I'm sure a lot of the listeners would like to learn more about it. So how can they do that?
Absolutely. Yeah. So the first thing you can always do, you can go to our website, www.nolawater.org, and see what our upcoming events are. We also have a Facebook and an Instagram if you prefer those mediums as well. But one of the things I maybe failed to mention is that we have working groups, and it's open to the public and free for anyone to join and participate. We have those meetings monthly, and you can, again, look that up on our website. But the main thing is that you can come just to listen, or you can come to add, you can come to make suggestions. Anyone who's interested in water, whether it's from stormwater management to coastal to gray infrastructure, is welcome to come. But even people who are interested and don't have the expertise are welcome to come. So that's one way you can definitely get involved right off the gate. And then, of course, we have lots of events start, especially next year. We have quite a few. And then we are a nonprofit. So if you want to donate on our website, you can definitely do so as well. We're always raising funds. And unfortunately, just like everyone in COVID, we weren't able to do big fundraisers this year. But we're really grateful to our members and our partners who have donated and maintained, help us maintain our ability to function during these difficult times. So we welcome you to join us. And we're locally based, but I see us as a regional and a national movement. And I think other people recognize that as well. So we invite you to come and get involved in any way you see fit.
All right. And I encourage all the listeners to do exactly what she just said. So Jessica Dandridge of the Water Collaborative, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. This has been great. I really am excited to have this conversation with you, and I look forward to doing more.
And from all of us here at the Future Cities Podcast, we want to thank you very much for your interest and for listening. This is Robert Lloyd signing off. Until next time.
The Future Cities Podcast is an outreach effort brought to you by the Urban Resilience to Extremes Sustainability Research Network, or UREX as we usually refer to it. To learn more about UREX, visit www.sustainability.asu.edu/urban-resilience. If you have any questions, feedback, or suggestions for future episodes, you can email us at futurecitiespodcast@gmail.com or find us on Twitter at futurecitiespod. If you enjoyed the episode, please rate and subscribe to us wherever you get your podcasts. See you next time.